here in the midst of a great crisis in our Ulster province. And the marching feet of the Protestants today caused the traitor to tremble.
Those were the words of Ian Paisley, the founder of the Democratic Unionist Party.
Let it go out that we're cool, determined loyalists who will never surrender.
They were committed to upholding Britain's sovereignty in the North by any means necessary.
We are opposed to a united Ireland. We will not have a united Ireland.
Someone didn't fly over Northern Ireland and drop some sort of loony gas. And suddenly people woke up one morning as killers. Conditions were created in this country whereby people done things they shouldn't have done.
Just come to a realisation then that this wasn't a game, this isn't a game. This is a war going on here.
Once they snap, we will snap.
I will go to the grave with the conviction I have.
The DUP were the only major party that opposed the Good Friday Agreement in 1998.
Let me tell you something. We'll be saying no on the 22nd of May.
I felt that it was the saddest day that Ulster has ever had since the founding of the province.
They eventually changed tack, entering a power-sharing agreement in 2007. Even one of Northern Ireland's most extreme unionist figures eventually made peace.
From the depths of my heart, I can say to you today that I believe Northern Ireland has come to a time of peace, a time when hate will no longer rule.
The rising support for the DUP in the north of Ireland is to this day one of the central paradoxes of the Good Friday Agreement. Even now, the language of no surrender has been raised again, not by the now deceased Paisley Sr., but by his son, at Brexit Party rallies in 2019.
100 years of history teaches unionism one thing. We ain't disposable. We ain't being kicked away so easily. We are here for the long term. We are here to stay. No surrender.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast. And this, the second part of our special report on Northern Ireland amidst the Brexit crisis. I'm Luke Cooper, and with my co-host Zoe Williams, we went to the north of Ireland to challenge our own ignorance and to get a sense of the six counties' special place in the unfolding disaster of Brexit. In part one, we looked at how the histories of the Troubles reverberate into the present day. Now, in part two, we take a closer look at the current moment in Northern Ireland's politics. We ask whether and how there might be a way out of this divide, or is history simply moving in the direction of the green side, that ultimately, for practical as well as historical reasons, there will be a single government on the island of Ireland. Peter Hayne, who acted as the Northern Ireland Secretary in the last Blair government, played a central role in getting the DUP on board after decades of shouting never, never and no surrender. He describes the compromise struck as ultimately flawed.
It was an entirely artificial form of politics. It was necessary, and I still think it is necessary, and for a while it will remain necessary, but it is not a natural construct.
The deal that brought the DUP to the table gave the executive more power over the elected assembly of 90 representatives. Known as the St Andrews Agreement, brokered in 2006, it meant the two largest parties on either side of the unionist and nationalist divide would nominate the first and deputy ministers of the assembly, rather than the assembly as a whole, which was the system envisaged by the Good Friday Agreement. That meant if you wanted to elect the government, you had to back the two largest parties on either side, so sectarian voting was encouraged. Not only was the difference between Orange, those that wanted to maintain the union with Britain, and Green, those that wanted a union with Southern Ireland acknowledged, but the very constitutional structure of the Stormont Executive required it to persist. As Mick Fealty, who runs the blog Slugger O'Toole, explains.
There's no way that you could describe Northern Ireland as a classic example of classical democracy. It was from the very beginning a construct. It has been described as having the ugly scaffolding of democracy. And that's partly because it's been an enabling mechanism. It was felt necessary at the very beginning to create this stable condition.
Not all parties, however, accept the division between Orange and Green. Lisburn is traditionally a staunchly unionist area, but we spoke to Saoirse Eastwood on the campaign trail for the Alliance Party. They are unusual in Northern Ireland politics because, along with the Green Party, they do not identify as either nationalist or unionist.
It's like a kind of a sitcom version of canvassing, like everybody really friendly, chatting on the doorstep.
Yeah. So what does Alliance mean to you in terms of, you know, it's not a vote for Orange and Green, it's a vote really for a united community, isn't it really?
Well, that's it. I think it's time that people need to move beyond that, especially this past couple of years has shown that Orange and Green don't get us anywhere.
Yeah.
And people are sick of it. Basically, when you look at the nurses and the fire services and everything and having to go out and strike.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, there's no government there for them to negotiate
exactly
with.
And the fact that the only voices that we've had in Westminster have been the DUP and Geoffrey Donaldson for this constituency,
yes,
it just doesn't represent
people.
No,
they don't represent everybody.
Intercommunal tensions are hardly unusual in the new world order of the 21st century. While many people may have once seen the language of Ian Paisley as the rhetoric of the dinosaur, today, the hope that these kinds of politics would decline looks increasingly misplaced. Garrett Carr explained this as, in a way, the Ulsterisation of world politics.
What I find really interesting is that normally, in any binary argument, let's call that argument whether you have a united Ireland or whether you don't, you can tell immediately what side whoever you're talking to is on.
Yes.
Whereas I actually can't find that instant bit of recognition. Since we've been here, I haven't instantly been able to recognise the true feelings of the person I'm talking to.
That's good, isn't it?
Well, it's really interesting to me that it's not completely obvious.
Yeah. Seamus Heaney, not long before he died, wrote to a friend of his and he talked about it's like the world is becoming a big Ulster. But I think, I can't remember what he was referring to. I think he might have been referring to Eastern Europe at the time. But he's right. What's happened is now London politics has become kind of Ulsterized.
Mm.
And US politics as well, where things become very tribal, binary, and rather faith-based. And the irony is that just as Ulster gets beyond its Ulsterfied politics, other places seem to be sinking into them.
We recounted to him our conversation with the car rental employee when we first arrived, a unionist remainer supportive of the open border and the peace process, but who voted DUP because he wanted to maintain the union. How did this confirm, but also complicate, the politics of the North?
What you actually discovered, he had a diversity of views, and he felt, sounds like, that he was no longer really able to fit into that frame. And again, that's a great imaginative leap, and you'll meet a lot of people like that now. I'd like to think maybe most people. And that's a space that's opened up. The Good Friday Agreement has a lot of responsibility for that, and it's enabled people to talk about other things and think about themselves in other ways, and given space to those kind of imaginative leaps.
We saw some of these leaps over in Lisburn when we were shadowing the Alliance Party.
I just think it's time for a change. I know we say in our house, because there's autism in our house, we've been affected with waiting lists and everything.
Yeah.
And there's nobody to go and talk to as such because we don't have a government to take on these issues.
Exactly.
And, you know, I know from talking to some of the local autism charities that there's paperwork sitting on desks that can't be signed off on because we don't have a functioning government.
Exactly, and we need to get new voices in, people like Alliance who are coming together, you know, that united community fee, putting people first and protecting people.
I think that's the key to it. Somebody's going to represent everybody.
Yeah.
And everybody's voice will be heard.
Exactly.
You know, both here in Northern Ireland and across in Westminster.
Well, listen, thank you so much.
Good luck. Good luck. I hope it goes well.
Nice.
I'm going to give you that back.
Because you know,
you,
already.
Yes, you know, you see, it can be shared with our vote.
Thank you.
And this house here, so no.
Thank you so much.
Cheers.
Thanks.
Well.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So, she's not a plant. She's not social dancing.
That was really good. I've got to say, to walk in the middle of a conversation that's going, we need to move beyond orange and green, is like about as good luck as you can possibly
but
get.
But you know what? That's why I wanted you guys to be here, because, you know, all people have heard, you know, particularly with GB audience, is that, you know, the DUP are over there and people somehow seem to think that they speak for Northern Ireland, and they don't. And even in constituencies like this where, you know, there have been MPs like Geoffrey Donaldson who have been about for a long time, the appetite is changing. You know, and in May, in this particular constituency, we topped the poll in every district for the local government elections, and then at the end of that same month we went on to get our first MEP with Naomi Long in Europe. So, you know, the momentum is there, it's building behind us, and, you know, it's really not a surprise that every other door that we go to knock, people are saying, you know what, we're fed up, we don't want that DUP representation anymore, we want a party that actually represents everybody. You know, and even people that voted to leave are saying, look, they're almost coming to the door and apologising and saying, we voted to leave and we don't think that that's the right decision. And I'm saying, look, you don't have anything to apologise for at all. People were sold something that was never going to be able to materialise, and a lot of people believed that figure on the side of the bus, and, you know, that really manipulated them. They thought that was going to be a straightforward, you know, investment into the health service. Northern Ireland has some of the biggest waiting lists in the UK. You just heard there from that constituent that impacted on her son, you know, and his quality of life. So people are fed up. They're coming to us because they see us as the only viable alternative, and that's what we're saying in this constituency. It's a straight two-horse race between the DUP or the Alliance Party.
But the structure of the Good Friday Agreement makes it hard to break out of sectarianism.
The Good Friday Agreement, unfortunately, shores up those sort of sectarian politics, because you have to have unionist and nationalist represented in government. Mm. So therefore, although in some ways it makes great strides against sectarianism, it does copper fasten that element. There's also, I suppose, a sense of horse trading was about to happen just after the Good Friday Agreement, and so people reverted to what they considered to be their strongest position. Mm. So the DUP last night just released their party political broadcast for the upcoming election, and it's quite striking because there's no policies in it. Brexit is not mentioned. It's entirely about delivering a good deal for Northern Ireland. That's all it is, this rather abstract notion of we will go to Westminster and look out for you.
We asked Saoirse Eastwood about her own electoral prospects.
Was the DUP majority last time quite significant?
It was quite a significant majority the last time round, but what we are saying on this occasion is that so much has changed. People are now starting to question the likes of Brexit. People have seen the DUP's voting record in Westminster, particularly on health, and that's scaring them because they want people like us, they want Alliance MPs back in Westminster again, who will vote to protect the NHS, who will vote to support public sector workers, who will vote to try and improve quality of life and afford rights to as many people as possible, rather than a party that seems to set out its stall on stopping rights for certain elements of the community, you know.
And it was so interesting to hear her immediate reaction, because austerity is a unifier, and it's not a British thing, it's not an Irish thing, it's even a European thing, that, and a unifier in terms of social class as well, because this is an affluent area earlier, but yeah. he still needs services. She was talking about the firefighters, yeah. etc. So,
yeah. Exactly. And, you know, as you say, it's not a class thing. It's nothing like that at all. It's a very unifying concept and it impacts on everybody. And I think once people knew that the DUP were over propping up the Conservative government, largely voting with them in the main, particularly on social issues, they just thought, you know what, that's not for us. We actually need to get behind a party that we can trust, that we know will fight our corner and has our best interests at heart, like Alliance.
And who would the ideal Westminster government be for you? Say you're returned as the MP, what's the ideal result look like?
I think basically anybody that puts Northern Ireland first and puts our people first. We have had a series of elections over the last few years that have really, in some shape or form, impacted on the situation here, where we haven't really had fully engaged all-party talks. That's obviously something that both the British and Irish government are bound to do as guarantors of the Good Friday Agreement. We will work with anybody who is willing to put Northern Ireland first. And obviously what we've seen with the likes of Brexit is that Northern Ireland really came as an afterthought. Mm-hmm. Nobody thought about the impact of that, and that really got to the heart of the problem, where you had the whole of Europe, you know, you had the Commission, you had absolutely everybody, you had the likes of Nancy Pelosi, you know, US representatives, everybody getting involved, and it really just bore out that theory that they hadn't actually considered Northern Ireland.
It sounded, just from that one data point, like the close down at Stormont is a more pressing issue than Brexit. Is that right, or are they equally pressing?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. You can't really discuss one without the other. And as we saw, one of the most recent outcomes was actually looking at that issue of consent, because obviously Northern Ireland voted to remain, and then there became this conversation within Europe about, well, how are we going to maybe look at consent then? The bald fact of the matter is that Northern Ireland did vote to remain, and certainly if you're going to go by consent, you know, people didn't want that generally. Now, you know, almost 4 years on to the process, people have had time to look and reconsider, and they're saying absolutely not. Maybe we voted to leave, but we certainly wouldn't do that again. And if you look at the likes of, you know, local government or assembly, you would be looking at a new election for a new mandate. So that's another one of our key things that we have promised to our people, is that we will fight for a people's vote.
And just for an English listener, where would you put the Alliance politically? I mean, would you say you were most like the Lib Dems, the most like the SNP?
We obviously have a very close relationship with the Lib Dems, in that we're, you know, a Liberal Party. We work with them on a number of things. But for example, whenever Naomi Long was our MP in Westminster, she didn't take their whip. She did her own thing from our party perspective. Firstly, we are a party that values everybody's freedoms and everybody's beliefs. We are a very liberal party in terms of, you know, everyone's right to be socially progressive, economically progressive, all those sorts of things. I suppose in terms of a GB audience, Lib Dems at a rough glance, but there would also be differences as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's difficult to kind of put a circle into a square, but I suppose that would be a rough yardstick. However, there would be a lot of our supporters who would be maybe Labour. It's really just a mixed bag, but I suppose in terms of Northern Ireland, we're a very unique party. We have people from right across the community, and that has been one of our USPs for the last number of years that a lot of people have gathered around.
It was clear to us that the European Union and the Good Friday Agreement are deeply interconnected. We asked Katie Hayward to put these pieces into place for us.
How does the EU feel about the GFA and the British playing kind of fast and loose with it?
So it is notable that if you're thinking about what the EU has said since the triggering of Article 50, it's been very clear. It says, for example, to quote the European Council guidelines, said it's of paramount importance to protect the peace process and uphold the Good Friday Belfast Agreement. One thing I would say just anecdotally is, in part because of the efforts of the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs, I must say, but there's a very good knowledge and understanding of the Good Friday Agreement in other EU countries, but most particularly in Brussels, whereas that isn't necessarily the case in London.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, when that was agreed, Tony Blair is very much associated with all of that. And for sort of a different generation, you know, for those of us here, trying to convey the fact that this isn't just an Irish thing, it's the British are co-guarantors of the Good Friday Agreement, and they have ownership of this, you know, it's something they should be proud of, apart from anything else. It was so hard won in terms of all the diplomacy behind it, and that's a real shame.
And it must have been frustrating then, in that context, that in the pro-Brexit referendum itself, I mean, there was hardly any mention of the Northern Ireland context at all. Francis O'Grady, the TUC president, who is of Irish descent, so it makes sense. I mean, she's British, but her family were originally from Ireland, did mention it in the leaders' debate. And to the best of my knowledge, that was the only high-profile moment where the Good Friday Agreement was mentioned. So we get the UK as a whole, not Northern Ireland, of course, narrowly voting to remain in the EU, but the UK as a whole taking this huge constitutional decision without any consideration of the impact on the Good Friday Agreement and the constitutional complexity of Northern Ireland, and seems unbelievably irresponsible.
Well, the Good Friday Agreement sits uneasily with a simplistic understanding of sovereignty. So although it's, you know, reinforcing in many ways sort of, you know, the validity of nationalism, if you like, from the Irish side and the British side, at the same time, it complicates it in a very practical way. I have to acknowledge that George Osborne did come to Warren Point Harbour down Ninurie and don a hard hat and did say, you know, Brexit could mean customs and tariffs and barriers to trade.
He did do that,
and there is film footage to prove that. It didn't generate many headlines, I have to say. But one thing that really struck me was Teresa Villiers, who was the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland at the time. Of course, she was campaigning to leave, and she was at an event in Derry City, and prospect of a hard border and the impact of Brexit on the Good Friday Agreement was mentioned, and she said, "There's never been a hard border on the island of Ireland."
That's extraordinary.
Yes. Well, I thought it really was extraordinary, given that within a decade since the last remnants of the military watchtowers had been removed, not far from where she was sitting. I thought it was extraordinary until Arlene Foster said
it. Did you think it was ignorance, or was it, you know, they do gaslight us quite a lot?
Yeah. Well, Arlene Foster then repeated that phrase maybe 18 months later about never being a hard border.
But she can't have forgotten.
She definitely hasn't. No, I mean, that's very important to her political identity, of course, and her politics and coming from the border region. Teresa Villiers, I don't know. I think she said it because she probably... I, who would know?
Who knows?
Who knows? Maybe we have to stop there.
Who
knows? And people would say all sorts of things in that campaign. But now it comes to this question of, well, as Arlene Foster would say, what is the significance of Brexit to the Good Friday Belfast Agreement? You know, how many times is the EU mentioned in the agreement, etc.? And it's basically ignoring the fact that the context of European integration formed the framework and the model for the Good Friday Agreement. More particularly, for better British-Irish relations. And that's fundamental to all of this, you know, and that's why I really would worry for the future, because regardless of what happens within Belfast, etc., if you have a breakdown in that relationship...
Yeah, which has already happened.
It's certainly under pressure and strain, and it's hard to see how it will improve.
It's gone from its historic golden period in positive relations since the 1990s, and related, of course, to the peace process, and in a very short space of time seems to have crashed quite badly. The dominant position is to treat the Irish border as a trade problem, but it is about political identity, belonging, and the basis for peaceful relations between Britain, Ireland, and the rest of Europe.
If the EU conceives itself even partly, and of course there's lots of other things too, but if it conceives itself even partly as a peace project, the Good Friday Agreement goes right to the heart of why it happened in the first place. If you can see it that way, then actually everything follows. And it seems that so far the EU are holding with that, and they are emphasising keeping Ireland's border open. The EU as a peace machine works on free trade. And you don't go to war with people you do business with. So, and their vision of things, I suppose, that they're just inextricably linked. And they see defending one as defending the other. And on Ireland's border, I suppose it's a case in point. What does it mean if the border is open? Is that businesses can function there and people can make a decent livelihood and the whole place can just sort of function quite smoothly. But then there is this important aspect to it as well, where it isn't just that your truck is slowed down or you have to pay export duties. It is that you aren't having your identity confronted. Questions of your identity aren't being thrown up at you every time you go to cross that border. So it ends up being either a challenge or soft in two ways. Soft on your identity and soft on your business as well. and they are impossible to separate.
For Republicans, Brexit represents a major opportunity for a united Ireland. But they are also keen to point out that the peace process in itself represents a huge step forward from the situation the community faced in the 1980s, as Mickey Brady explained.
Of course there are two narratives. You know, unionists have a narrative, nationalist Republicans have a narrative, but with both of them, there's obviously a degree of truth. But, I mean, as someone who's Sinn Féin public representative, I have never tried to rewrite history. I mean, I can only tell it as it was, how it affected me, how it affected my family, how it affected my community. And when you're saturated with British soldiers who were stopping you literally in one occasion, I used to go to Cross Maitland when I was an advice worker from 1981 onwards, when I started as a welfare rights worker. And there were mornings going and 16 miles from here to Cross Maitland, I could be stopped 10 times by British Army, you know, and sometimes felt it was uncalled for. Maybe they thought it was necessary. I certainly didn't, because it was interfering with what you did. Mm. I mean, I was out there to basically help people in the community in terms of giving them advice about benefits and entitlements and all, because if you look back, we always tried to get unemployment figures for that area and we could never get them because we're all lumped together. But there may well have been anything to 40-50% unemployment in that area. Mm. Kilkeel, which is a fishing port, at one time we were told it had the third highest unemployment in Western Europe. You know, so we lived in an area, a sort of border corridor, which partition created more problems than it ever solved, and it, as far as I'm concerned, it never solved any problems, because you had that sort of area running from north down right through to, say, Drogheda, where, you know, partition never gave any economic, social or any other type of benefit. It was a disaster. And to me, it was a short-term solution to a long-term problem, because I would imagine it was never meant to last. So what happened was you had two states, or two statelets, if you like, created, both economically weren't feasible.
I'm fascinated by this because I'm getting two arguments, not necessarily in contradiction, but they're both there. And one is about bringing both communities together, and you even said there were elements of truth in the different history that you don't agree with. And there's another argument, which is, look, partition was a disaster and I'm still an Irish Republican. The Good Friday Agreement, in a sense, is an attempt to manage both of those arguments.
Of course, and the whole issue of consent is enshrined, and this is why, in terms of Brexit, the Good Friday Agreement, all of its parts have to be implemented in full. It's an international agreement. It's largely United Nations. The British government and the Irish government are both co-guarantors. And even some Tories in Britain, I think it was Patterson, who used to be a Secretary of State here, Owen Patterson, he was sort of saying, oh, it's reached a sell-by date kind of thing. That's nonsense. And in fact, when Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of Congress, was here, I listened to her speech in Dublin, and she said very clearly, unless the Good Friday Agreement was implemented in full, if it was in any way in danger, no free trade agreements would be signed between Britain and America.
If you have the United Ireland, you would still need some kind of special process, which is like the Good Friday Agreement, to try to bring these communities together as well.
Yeah, but I think the first thing I would say about Alliance, and I worked with him, and I was a storeman for 8 years, Alliance are a unionist party. Whatever they may say, they're a unionist party. And again, they're a bit like the Liberal Democrats. This is only a personal observation. The Liberal Democrats can promise anything because, you know, and when they didn't manage to get in the coalition with the Tories, they didn't do very well. And their alliance is sister party. So again, when we talk about reunification, there has to be a long conversation and there has to be a sitting down with people. And the example, statistically, if you look at unionists and unionism in the north, in British context, they have less than 2% of the vote. In an All-Ireland context, they would probably have about 23% of the vote, maybe more. So that would give you a fairly good mandate in a United Ireland. But if we're going to convince people that United Ireland is the way forward, there's two things, I think, two major things have to be dealt with. One is having a proper health service, which is free at the point of access, and which actually works. Because the British one, see, Boris is trying to flog it off the Americans, I've no doubt about that. And it doesn't work in Britain. And we hear so much about it not working here. But I'll give you again the example. I was in the Health Committee when I was in Stormont for the 8 years that I was there. And 43% of the executive budget went towards health. and the other 57 had to go towards infrastructure, education and the rest of it. 43% was nowhere near enough. To me, it hasn't been addressed, and I listen to Legge and Nolan every day, and the real issues aren't addressed in that. We do not have fiscal levers. We cannot raise taxes. We cannot raise money if we needed it to pay for things that are necessary, like the health service. So I think people need to get in their head, the six counties is a British colony. Whatever way you want to dress it up, and they give you X amount of money, and we have to make the best of it. Now, if the examinee was back and up and running in the morning, which I hope it will be very soon, you have local people making local decisions and can maybe move money around, but you're within that same slice of the pie. And, you know, they talk about all this subvention that we get, but if you go to the shopping centre and you're here, the bigger one, the Keys, and indeed the Buttercrane, but if you go down the Keys, you walk from Debenhams at one end to Sainsbury's at the other, you have Waterstones, Boots, Carphone Warehouse in between, all that money goes back to England. The only thing we get is what the Tories like to call the living wage, which is far from a living wage, or the minimum wage, whatever people want to call it. So, like, we pay taxes, you know. So this idea that we're kind of living off the British state, absolute nonsense. I mean, I've been dealing with the benefit system since the 70s, and everything that has come in has been cut. Nothing has ever benefited the claimant. Nothing. Now we have universal credit, which we told them from day one would never work. And yet they insisted, Duncan Smith, even the architect, Duncan Smith, is now pulling back. Corbyn has said he'll abolish it if Labour get in. So, you know, all of that's happening. Yet it was a socialist government, when you think about it, so-called socialist Labour, who introduced student loans and all of that. So sometimes people speak with forked tongues.
Do you have mixed feelings about Brexit in that sense? Because Brexit seems to make a United Ireland much more likely.
Yes, absolutely. And for the first time in my lifetime, a southern government has actually started to address. I'll give you an example. As MPs, we sit on a Good Friday implementation committee in the Dáil. We have speaking rights but not voting rights. And Coveney, who's the Taoiseach Deputy Prime Minister, came and addressed that last year. And he actually said during his address, and this is on public record, that he hoped there would be a United Ireland in his lifetime. And in the same sentence, he changed it to his political lifetime. Now, for the first time in my lifetine, to actually hear Fine Gael, who are regarded as a right-wing party, to say that. Of course, reunification is closer. But you see, people, particularly in the unionist community, think, you know, we want to join up with the 26 counties in the morning. God forbid, you know, because who would want Leo Varadkar and people like him to actually be in charge? You know, what we're talking about is a new concept. We're talking about a new Ireland. We're talking about an inclusive Ireland. We're talking about, as I said, one that has... I listened to Nolan this morning, and there's a guy on. He said, Michelle O'Neill has been talking about the health system, and she's trying to move us into the south and abolish the National Health Service. That is nonsense. What we want to do is establish a proper health service.
I was fascinated by this exchange. It's an argument against what could be called the East German model. This month, after all, we celebrate 30 years since the Berlin Wall came down. A still to this day quite extraordinary moment of transformative political change. In a huge upsurge of emotion around German reunification, the two countries decided to unite, and the form this took, after elections that took place in the year 1990, was the simple absorption of East Germany into the West. It seemed to me like Mickey was, in a very thoughtful way, acknowledging this looks difficult for Northern Ireland, for the simple reason that many people in the North would find the outcome really tough to accept. So while the economic fiscal issue might raise similar questions to those East Germany encountered, the identity question is radically different. So, if there is to be a United Ireland, it would require a whole new constitutional settlement, not the simple passage of sovereignty to Dublin. Like in Germany, the issue, at risk of overstretching the analogy badly at this stage perhaps, is totemically represented by the existence of walls, the so-called peace walls, that still exist across the six counties. We asked Katie Hayward whether the stated goal of dismantling the walls by 2023 will be achieved. This, it seems, would be a huge step forward for peace. there's this proposal for them to be dismantled, or aim for them to be dismantled by 2023. It seems quite unlikely that the peace walls will be dismantled in 4 years' time, but that is the goal, is that right?
So we are heading in the right direction, and there are more barriers being removed or opened for longer periods of the year, that kind of thing. So things are going in the right direction. But you know, with each one of those barriers that's removed, it's quite a big deal. It involves negotiation with local communities and trust and confidence building. Mm. It's easy to throw these things up and then increase their height and their solid nature. It's much more difficult to take them down because that involves negotiating and, you know, reassuring people. So there is a target of 2023 to remove all the peace walls. The cynic in me would note that actually that was announced just before Obama came for the G8 summit in Fermanagh. And there was a bit of a crisis at the time in power sharing. And the leaders here were told, if you don't get your act together, Obama won't come. Or Obama would be very disappointed. So we really wanted a big and, you know, a nice thing to say. Northern Ireland is functioning, you know, it's not complete basket right. case. So that figure started to come around then. We have this Together Building United Community Strategy, TBUC, and that's part of it too, this idea of bringing them all down. Obviously, these peace walls are symbolic of other problems, and, you know, the poverty, the poor levels of educational qualifications, unemployment rates, levels of sickness, suicide, etc. in these areas really are symptomatic of much deeper problems, and the peace walls just exacerbate those difficulties and the difficulty in sort of having.
And how would you feel if they did come down?
Oh, it's got nothing to do with me. You know, really, like, I do think it's important that those who live beside the peace walls are consulted about it, and that they feel confident when they come down that they won't be needed again and that they won't be vulnerable. And that's a long, long, long process. You know, it's not just about how much antisocial behaviour there is in the region, how many contested parades. It's more about, are our politicians doing the job we expect them to do? You know, are they investing in, you know, health services and making sure the schools are performing as they should be, and, you know, there are jobs, etc., etc.? And until that's happening, bringing down the peace walls would only be something to sort of generate plaudits for some individuals for a certain period of time, and not necessarily in the longer term interests of the community.
So in a way, the invisible wall could persist after the physical wall is still there, in a way.
Obviously, people go with what's familiar to them. Mm. And just as we saw with the Irish border itself, patterns of movement and of behaviour work in response to barriers and to borders. And it takes a long time for lives to move across them and to have new habits and to move in different circles, etc. So that would take a long period of time. And you're absolutely right. That's about, yeah, the lingering border in people's minds. I was in ran a focus group the other day in Pettigo, which is a border village, you know, cut through by the Irish border, and some young lad was talking about the psychological iron curtain of the border and saying how it was lifted for a period of time, especially once the younger generation after the Good Friday Agreement, and they said now it's beginning to creep back again. So borders and barriers, including walls like this, can actually have a lingering effect, and it's interesting that, you know, they can be rebuilt again, and a lot of it depends on, you know, the kind of behaviour of those at the highest levels, including the British and Irish governments.
30 years on from the fall of the Berlin Wall, and just over two decades since the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, we are reminded again that peace building is a process, and that negotiation between elites at the top is not enough. Involvement of communities and the ongoing improvement of their everyday lives will be the critical yardstick for its ultimate success. That concludes the second of this two-part special edition of the Another Europe podcast. If you found it useful to listen to, as we found it enlightening to make, then please consider supporting us by joining the campaign. Just go to anothereurope.org/join. You can also support the podcast by leaving us a rating or review on your podcast platform. We'll be back very soon. See you then.